From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. The city of Atlanta has given the green light to a $100 million expansion of Piedmont Park. It's hard to argue with adding green space to an increasingly bustling and growing city, but not all green spaces are equally accessible, and some Atlantans argue that the city should be funding development of new open spaces in other parts of town. Today on our show, we're going to consider the many ways that green spaces, or lack thereof, affects communities around Georgia. We're also going to check with some innovative programs that expand access to healthy food and to healthy activities. Sean Cannon has been reporting on green space development as associate editor of Curbed Atlanta. Welcome, Sean.
Thanks for having me.
And Mario Cambardella is here. He's urban agricultural director in the mayor's office of resilience. Hello, Mario.
Hello. Good morning.
Glad you're here. Sean, first to you. Atlanta City Council just approved $20.4 million for purchase of land for the Piedmont Park expansion. Can you walk us through the plans?
Sure. So to give you a little background, this project was the last thing former Mayor Kasim Reed had the pleasure of unveiling and to some extent making part of his legacy, although obviously Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms will oversee how the plans shake out. Reed announced the plan, which is to add an additional acreage to the already massive Piedmont Park during his last ever press conference. He said $100 million would be used to fuel the park's expansion, which could one day see the outdoor Midtown Hub and its neighboring botanical garden bloom from the current 185-acre stature into an even larger network of grass plains, pathways, and flowers, spanning all the way to the corner of Piedmont Avenue and Monroe Drive, the north side.
Well, as big as it is, it still is not, some people point out, as big as other big parks in other cities,
that's
correct?
Right.
So this is, what's the goal here? I mean, how is this being paid for?
Well, as you already said, it's obviously a major hub of Midtown. And so the way that's going to be shaken, or the way that's going to play out, this $100 million will be split up into chunks. $20 million of that was just approved by the city council to come in the form of a check by the city. About half of that, and this is slightly controversial, will come in the form of T-SPLOST funds. That's the Transportation Special Purpose Local Option Sales Tax. I think I get that right. Now, some people take issue with using those tax funds to fund a park when, as Council Member Natalyn Archibong suggested, that those funds could be used to go towards other infrastructure initiatives.
So the opposition is about other infrastructure initiatives, not necessarily building other parks or developing other green space in other parts of town.
Exactly. Now, the part of the plan that earned the funding from the Atlanta City Council got approval in late May. The remaining $80 million, however, is slated to come via sources, other sources of philanthropic efforts. Where exactly the planners are going to find that cash, I can't be sure, but with a site abutting the Eastside Beltline Trail project, funds might be easier to secure than a project would be elsewhere, but I can't be certain.
Well, so, Murray, lay out a picture of Atlanta for us, you know, an idea of where green spaces are and how they're used.
Well, I'm a part of the urban agriculture movement here in Atlanta as the urban agriculture. Oftentimes I call myself the urban agriculture directed, and where I'm listening to a number of people that have said we need access to green space. We need access to open land so that we can take control, or we can take ownership of our local food system here in Atlanta. So I'm working on developing programs that meet those needs.
And who are the we's in this case? Is this in any particular area of town or any particular demographic?
Gardens happen all over the city. They really do. Everybody's looking for a space to grow, but there are some areas of the city that don't have good access to traditional grocery stores like some areas of our town do. So we're prioritizing our time and attention and funds to make sure that the areas that do not have traditional access to fresh, nutritious foods are getting the opportunity to have five-year leases, get access to green space, to get access to properties where they can develop their own access to fresh, nutritious foods.
And if you're looking at an aerial map of Atlanta, are some of these areas already pointed out where you could see the development of these kind of agricultural centers?
Well, USDA does a great job of developing some tools, some atlases of our city that show where food access is more prevalent and where there's some significant challenges. So we use some of these tools, these GIS, geographic informational systems, to tell us where some of those key points are that we need to bring resources and attention to.
So where is Atlanta hurting for green space?
Well, in some of these areas where they're looking at urban agriculture to build community gardens and urban farms in areas where there's blighted and vacant properties.
Mm-hmm.
And so these communities can take ownership of those areas. of those properties build in their own green space, because each one of these community gardens, each one of these urban farms is a place of green space. Not necessarily a park, but it is access to nature. It is access to growing their families, their persons, but also their communities.
Then what needs to be done in order to, many of these industrial sites, you know, there have been chemicals or things seeping into the ground for a long time. How much does it take to prepare one of these spaces and transform it?
Well, many of these places are residential neighborhoods. This was the corner lot that was collecting tires. Mm-hmm. And so we get to transform that greatest liability in their community and turn it into their best asset, remove the tire and put a lush, bountiful garden in there. So that's elevating the whole for this community in a way that that we just haven't done before. We haven't had a formalized, institutionalized urban agriculture program before this. So we're working right now. We've taken over 4 properties, turned those into community gardens, and those communities have kind of taken ownership of them. We have 4 more coming out in October, and then by the end of next year, we'll be at 25 acres of urban agriculture opportunities in that's green space for communities in which where they reside. So we're really leading with a program called Aglanta Grows a Lot. And that is the program. You can find more information on
that. Grows a lot.
Grows a lot. You see what I did there? Okay, good. So these programs enable communities to take access where they need it the most.
Okay, so to you, Sean, I mean, there's so much development going on in Atlanta right now. Is there accounting for green space? I mean, Mario's talking about existing neighborhoods. How about in new developments? Mm-hmm.
It's definitely difficult to keep track exactly of where green spaces are popping up or being killed. But reading the news, you see a lot of headlines recently about this apartment tower or this office complex or this mixed-use developments especially. We're seeing a good deal of projects flaunting green space embedded within them. You know, sometimes it's a rooftop terrace with a small garden. Sometimes it's a courtyard opening up to retail options, anchoring residential developments. Sometimes, and this one I find particularly interesting, it's a tiny park that could one day plant its roots at the city's most popular photography spot, the Jackson Street Bridge. Hmm. I think it was Atlanta Magazine's inimitable Thomas Wheatley who first broke the news of the quote-unquote parklet that's slated to be installed on the bridge as part of the city's new placemaking program, which we can touch on later, but it's definitely an interesting idea. Suffice to say, however, it's not so simple to cheer on the small wins without contemplating the wreckage to the ecosystem that also comes along with Atlanta's trend of developing denser and denser spaces. Mm. You know, I'm no architect, nor am I a construction worker, although I used to be, but we'll save that for another day. People tend to expect that when a building is planned, crews need to come and clear out the plot, build a big concrete foundation. Sometimes that entails chopping down trees, sometimes not. Regardless, it's a common conception that a new building means less space to plant plants. Many times that's the case. But as I mentioned before, you can stick greenery into the sides of a building or the base or at the top of the building. But what's getting people really riled up, environmental conservationists particularly, is when developments require clear cutting.
So clear cutting like they do in forests when they're logging.
Right.
Just taking it all down.
Mm-hmm.
That's Sean Kennan. He's from Curbed Atlanta. Mario Combardella is also with us. He's the Urban Agriculture Director at the Office of Resilience for the City of Atlanta. What is it? What is the connection between resilience and urban agriculture?
Rooted citizenry. If we have people that are connected to the place in which they are growing and they are growing something, they're going to be more, they're going to be able to withstand greater storms. And so that level of connectedness within where they live and the community that they live in and have some of these assets, I believe we're going to be more resilient. Sorry to use the word again, but more resilient when we're faced with either chronic stressors like poor access to food or acute shocks that happen to our city, maybe a drought or something catastrophic when it happens. We're going to be more prepared to have healthier bounce back and have healthier opportunities for prosperity. I think one of the, not to count it a small win, but a big win was the 7.1 acres that we preserved as the city's first food forest. This was something that was slated for clear cutting that we rallied the troops through Conservation Fund, U.S. Forest Service, federal, state, county, local, everyone came in together and established a preserve of 7.1 acre that was a former farm, still has the historic pecan orchard on it. We were able to preserve all those trees and really teach in programming how farming happened 100 years ago when everything was organic. There was no USDA organic.
Right.
Everything was organic. So we are preserving some of these areas. I don't see them as small wins. I see them as great wins. I see them as the city of Atlanta leading really the conversation of urban agriculture, not just as ag tech or community gardens, but thinking outside the raised bed box and showing how we can develop food producing landscapes, integrate them all over the city.
So I can imagine those pockets of gardens all over the city and that connection to food being very close. We know that the development of farmers markets and the popularity of farmers markets in the last 20 years has really taken off. But I do also know, this is completely anecdotally, speaking to someone at Grand Park Farmers Market, saying that they do have the opportunity for SNAP benefits to be doubled at the farmers market, but people don't use them. They're not seeing a lot of people actually use them. So it's one thing if you provide that food. It's another thing to get public participation, and I wonder what you're thinking about how to get more public participation.
So I think you brought up a great point. You know, there's access issues, and then there's also affordability issues, but there's also acceptance issues. So we need to be more willing to assist some of these great organizations like Wholesome Wave Georgia that are convening community around farmers markets and contributing the 2-for-1 SNAP. I think that we all need to be putting spotlights on them and helping them through culinary demos, chef demos, showing people that the just how wonderful food can taste from local sources. So we have to collaborate to compete, but moreover, we have to collaborate to complete. If we're not collaborating with those organizations that are providing those amazing services for our citizens, they were not going to be able to do it on their by themselves. So in the spirit of collaboration, I need to do a better job in highlighting some of these public benefits services to make sure that every citizen knows that they are available, that are eligible, and that the other services like chef demos, like culinary demos, like those acceptability are in place so that when those services come to those citizens, they know how to use them, they know what it's for, and they know how much it's going to benefit them, their families, and their communities.
So, Sean, you look a lot at the pressures of development on land use, obviously. Is there an appetite outside of the areas that are being developed for, you know, apartments for people who can afford luxury apartments and even middle-income apartments? Is there that much appetite outside of those areas for developing green spaces in the city?
Well, I would like to say so. I mean, I think a lot of people still consider this to be the quote-unquote city in the forest. You know, if I could just drop a quick anecdote, I was at the new Hotel Claremont recently, and if you look inwards towards the city, you'll realize, you know, it can be hard to remember that nickname. But if you look to the east side toward Freedom Park and beyond, there's obviously this beautiful, lush green that takes up most of the view. Now, Atlanta's tree coverage stats have long been teetering around optimistically 50%, meaning like from a bird's eye view, about half the city shaded in green. With recent development, population influxes, and myriad Atlanta neighborhoods, I'd gamble we're not quite there anymore. And frankly, a recent Daily Beast article suggested that we dropped to around 45% tree coverage in the past few years. There's obviously developments that have raised the ire of conservationists by chopping down trees en masse.
Well, Sean, I'm going to have to leave it there. We're going to explore this question a lot more in this hour. Sean Cannon, Associate Editor of Curbed Atlanta, Mario Combradella from the Mayor's Office of Resilience. Thank you so much for being with me.
Thank you.
From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Urban green spaces mean more to communities than just aesthetics or places to go for a run. Research connects obesity and some mental health disorders to the lack of open space, health risks which can be more prevalent in urban areas where there are few places to be active. Joining me to talk about the impacts of parks on mental and physical health are two research associates from the Georgia Health Policy Center. Jimmy Dills and Michelle Rushing are with me. Hello.
Good morning.
Morning. Thanks for having us.
Well, thanks for being here. Also speaking with us today is Venice Jennings. She's a biological scientist at the U.S. Forest Service in Athens. Hello, Venice.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thanks so much for coming. And I really want you to explain biological scientist. What do you do exactly?
Thank you. My title is biological science, and that's based on my coursework, but I'm a general research scientist with the USDA Forest Service.
So you look at how people interact with forests?
Oh, it can be a number of things across the gambit. For example, a big part of the intention of my research has been to assess what we've been learning on this topic through the years so that we can strategically talk with one another and provide a holistic approach to considering how green spaces can impact different dimensions of health and well-being.
So what are the things that you've discovered top line about that interaction?
Oh, a number of things. For example, there was a project that I was involved in that was published in 2016, where we looked at public parks across different cities in the U.S. and different aspects of well-being, particularly as those described by Gallup's Well-Being Index. And we found that cities with a larger coverage of public parks had overall higher levels of overall well-being, but also that was particularly driven by social and community as well as physical well-being.
Ah, so social and community. We've heard a lot about, you know, obesity. Mm-hmm. People mm-hmm. get out in the parks. Mm-hmm. They walk in the parks, and also the sort of psychic space. But the social interaction, that's interesting. What can you tell us about that?
It is. Our health is influenced by the context of place. There's a lot of discussion in the academic space about place-based health promotion, and these spaces can encourage people to get out, interact with others, whether that can be around particular gardening activities, sports. So this can improve or at least influence how we perceive our spaces and the people who live in them.
Well, let's look at this. Michelle and Jimmy, you've both done a lot of research on this. How urban spaces relate to health? Can you give us some sense of where the research is now?
Sure. There are a lot of studies that have been done. And so what we really do is we try to kind of aggregate all of those into a bigger picture of guidance, taking a lot of studies that have been done in very specific ways and just finding there are a lot of indirect benefits that can help the entire community, from parks where it simply contributes to better air quality and also kind of reducing the heat buildup in the community. And then there are also more immediate effects that can be achieved whether you use the park or not, in terms of people just seeing green space, being exposed to green space. We find that there are lower rates of stress, lower rates of depression, lower rates of violent behavior, better school performance for children. And of course, those are higher if you do use the park, but they really also benefit the whole community. And then also kind of moving down the chain for people who are using the parks, we really see a lot of physical activity benefits. You know, it's really a great space. It doesn't necessarily mean that if you live next to a park, you're automatically going to become more active. But for somebody who wants to be active, having that park available is really going to increase the opportunity and their chance of being active.
Well, use is something we definitely want to get to. But Jimmy, I want to get to you. The Georgia Health Policy Center, where you work, have co-facilitated a number of projects around Metro Atlanta, like the Atlanta Beltline. What kind of initiatives are taking place on the Beltline?
That's actually not what I do, but I know we've been working on that. Michelle can certainly speak more to it as she's more involved with that type of work. But I know there's a lot of work being done to get people out on the trail, using it safely, thinking about how it connects to the communities that it's in already and how that's going to grow in the places where it's continuing to be built out. And so it really is the idea of that common thread that runs through the community and really knits together different neighborhoods rather than creating barriers between them, which is what traditional transportation infrastructure would do in terms of large roads. But having park space be that connective tissue really sets the context for all these behaviors and positive health outcomes that we're talking about here.
So what do you do? Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I don't know if you have time. Really, we work a lot in the space that Venice really set up clearly of place-based health. And so we know that it's really important to have access to care and medical care. All those, the traditional health model is important. But over the last several decades, public health has started to really understand that you need to work on the context for behaviors and the environments where socialization happens, where people potentially have the chance to walk regularly to get to a park, to then meet with neighbors and participate in a festival or whatever the thing is going on there. But public health as a profession is really starting to think more about how can we strategically integrate into those policy-making, decision-making spheres in a constructive way and not just coming in from a regulatory, you know, you have to get your environmental contaminants down to this level,
right.
but really thinking about
right.
how do you create a supportive environment.
And behaviors and urban planning and infrastructure, all of those things are involved. Michelle, you having done this research, did you want to pick up on that?
Yeah, so the Beltline is a great example. We actually did a health impact assessment before it was even developed, which really provided some guidelines. So they were able to analyze park acreage per person all the way around the city and find that some quadrants were more underparked, as we call it, than others. But also the city of Atlanta in general has fewer park acres per person than many other cities do. And that's really one of those things that we find is generally going to influence the health of the entire community. I mean, we think about the U.S. as being, you know, we spend a lot on healthcare, but we don't get great value for our dollar. People are not necessarily living their longest potential lives or having the best potential health and being healthy every day because we don't have really healthy places to live. So we were using health impact assessment in that case. That was many years ago at this point. To really predict how the Beltline could be built out in order to maximize development so that it would make healthy places for people to live. And, of course, the big issue is making sure that those opportunities are distributed all the way around through all of our communities. We have many different communities, so making sure that the parks are developed across the city and also that people have access to all of the different areas and all of the different amenities that are developed. More recently, some things have been done. So, for example, the West Side Trail has been developed, and we've seen some opportunities, for example, with Kaiser Permanente of Georgia has partnered with the Beltline to actually put out some programs that will encourage people to use it, some walking groups, some bicycling activities, farm stands, play days, things like that.
Well, so I'm sure that becomes a selling point for the Beltline when they're presenting it to, you know, get funding. They say these are some of the benefits. How much do you think that actually, and Venice, maybe you can answer this, how much do you think that actually figures into the thinking of how cities, towns, places are developed?
Well, that can have different layers. For example, I was recently involved with a publication where we looked at inequitable access to green spaces and how that relates to issues around environmental justice, but also in the public health space, that can lead to the development of health disparities being major gaps in health. And that article looked at it from the context of outcomes such as cardiovascular diseases, obesity, psychological wellness, as well as heat-related illnesses. So it's something to consider, but again, there's also other social factors at play that can influence how these spaces are received by different communities.
That's Venice Jennings. She's a biological scientist at the U.S. Forestry Service in Athens. Also with me, we have Jimmy and Michelle, who are from the Georgia Health Policy Center. I was getting
you got
that
it.
Right. Good. Well, I want to pick up on that, what Michelle said about being underparked. And I think that's what your research has involved in a great way, Venice. What does that mean? What ideally, how much access or how far away from parks would people be? Do we know it to that? Can we draw a bead on that?
It can vary, quite honestly. For example, there have been different metrics for with the CDC. Was it the half mile, the residential distance, for example, within a half mile distance of a park? Throughout the years, studies have looked at it from the sense of proximity, but also overall coverage, because we're a moving population. And so the access or use or exposure to these spaces can really vary.
So, and how about in terms of access? Is it in walkability? Is it in public transportation? How does that all figure
out? A lot of the language is framed in the sense of a half mile radius.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And how many people in Georgia have access with that kind of proximity?
Oh, overall, that's a good question. I have to get back to you on that one.
Well, Jimmy, this is part of what you do, that kind of, you look at the infrastructure. What are the barriers, how people get there? There's programming, of course, like Michelle was talking about, but how about the actual infrastructure that gets people to parks?
Yeah, I think that goes back to what your earlier guests were talking about, of thinking about, I jotted it down, elevating the whole, and mm-hmm. thinking about whole communities and that whole system in which people live, work, play, worship, work, all those things. And with the half-mile radius, that a lot of research showed, you know, yes, that's a quick measure of accessibility proximity, but that's not all there is. You've got to mm-hmm. have things in the park that the local community, if it's a neighborhood park, that the local neighbors actually want to use and go to. And then if you're creating safe street and transportation networks that you can walk to. So if you're increasing that walkability on the way to the park, some of the research I've been involved with years ago now has, in DeKalb County specifically, showed that people were 20% more likely to walk to the park if their potential route to that park was more walkable. And we measured that and were able to put it in a model and be able to show that. And public health knows that parks are really a key venue for physical activity and the social interactions that happen that make a strong community.
And that walkability is not just proximity, correct? I mean, right. It's like actually some places sidewalks just run out.
Yes.
And they're not particularly good sidewalks or places to cross.
Exactly. And we found that the highest factor, at least in that one study that contributed to walkability, was the traffic. Mm-hmm. And so even though it was a walking study and you're studying a walking behavior, it was how busy was that road that you were walking alongside of. Even if there was a sidewalk there or not, it was more important that the potential pedestrian feel safer in that space and that it was a pleasant walk. And we differentiate between utilitarian and recreational physical activity. And so walking to the park is kind of utilitarian in the sense that you're using walking as transportation to get somewhere. Then in the park, your physical activity is recreation because you're playing in a softball league or whatever it might be. And the types of walking environments that spur those trips are slightly different. If you're walking to work every day on a commute, you want to probably the most direct route you can take. If you're walking to the park and it's a leisure walk, you might go a little bit out of your way to actually take a nicer route that's more pleasing to you aesthetically or feels safer because you're trying to integrate it into that sort of leisure trip rather than a work-related trip.
How about the safety once in the park? This is something that has varied and varies in different parks around the city, around the state, around the country.
Yeah, there are a lot of considerations about what actually makes a quality park. And of course, you can read for hours and hours about all of the ways that they measure those elements. It's definitely not just a matter of whether the park is physically there, but there are a lot of aspects in terms of how well it's maintained. Is the city doing a good job of maintaining it? Does it have a foundation, a Friends of the Park that is also helping with that maintenance? Are the neighbors involved? Do they call in when there's a problem with the park and try to get it fixed? So those things really contribute to perceptions of safety, and the perception of safety is a very important factor in whether people are using the park. And then coincidentally, whether people are using the park also helps make it safer because you have that sort of strength in numbers. When a lot of people are present, you're less likely to have an issue than potentially if you feel like you are very isolated. And so that's an important factor. And then there are other factors that really can be important as well to safety, just whether it really has the amenities and the design that is appropriate to the community and the intended users. So you can have a park also that just doesn't have amenities that attract people there. And so that will also affect the usage and the perception of the park and the perception of safety.
So you and Jimmy were researchers behind this health impact assessment for low-income housing credits. So this is focusing on creating policy to connected low-income housing with surrounding communities. Now, what did your research find about low-income areas and access to parks in particular?
We haven't actually measured the distribution of parks kind of statewide, but one thing that is great about our statewide policy is that you can use the presence of a park in order to kind of increase the points you're scoring towards your likelihood of getting the tax credit. So that's helping make sure that we do have a supply of affordable housing for lower-income households that do have access to parks. And then they're also really innovating with some interesting things now. For example, we had done some work with the State Health Department to look at some of the amenities that can be created on site. They have to have amenities, but it's a little bit general about what they can actually choose, the developer can choose to build on site. So it turned out that one of the things they had a lot of opportunities to build were community gardens. And developers were really interested in that. It's apparently a very popular amenity for many of the people who are looking to move into affordable housing. And it was relatively kind of easy for them to build. And it's also something that they can operate well, and they know it promotes the health of their residents, which is important. So that kind of became part of those actual scoring criteria, that they can build a community garden and get extra points. And actually work that up into part of their scoring.
So, of course, the idea of parks, beautiful. In all artistic renderings of projects and plans, it's always a park, and it looks beautiful, and people love to use it. Of course, we're all supporting that kind of idea. But we've got just a minute left, so, Vernice, I want to put this to you. With all of the development that's going on, and pressure on land and competition, the idea of parks may be great. How do you sell it in terms of policy?
Well, I can't necessarily directly speak to the policy piece, but I will speak to a recent commentary that I was involved with where it talked about urban green spaces and the pursuit of health equity being the opportunity for all of us to have an equal opportunity at achieving optimal health. And that comes from the standpoint of connecting these spaces to larger issues in the community. How does it interact with youth engagement, job creation, and revitalization? But there's also the piece of concern around gentrification that has come up in a number of low-income areas in the sense of this space is revitalized, but also can I stay?
Well, Vernice, I want you to stick around. Thank you so much. Vernice Jennings is a biological scientist at the U.S. Forest Service in Athens. Jimmy Dills and Michelle Rushing, both research associates for the Georgia Health Policy Center. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Thank you.
Stick around. There's a lot more coming up on Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Georgia's new hands-free driving law goes into effect on Sunday. We're going to learn about the new rules of the road on tomorrow's show, and we'd like to hear your questions. You can let us know what you think and what you're wondering about. Can you use your headphones? Can you not? Go to OST Talk on Facebook or Twitter or call us at 404-500-9457. And then be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 o'clock for more. Today, we are looking at access to green space or lack thereof, which affects every Georgian in one way or another. With us is Vernice Jennings. She's a biological scientist at the U.S. Forest Service in Athens. And we're going to explore communities around the state and figure out how they're trying to help everyone be healthier and check in with a few of them now. John Bennett is executive director of the Savannah Bicycle Program. Savannah Bicycle Campaign. And he's joining us from the GPB studio in Savannah. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
So what is the Savannah Bicycle Campaign?
People always ask us, what are you campaigning for? And our general goal is to make Savannah safer and friendlier for people who ride bikes, whether they're doing so for transportation or recreation.
So what does that mean? Do you creating roadways, you access to bicycles? What are you doing?
We work in a lot of different areas, all that conveniently begin with E. So encouraging people to ride through organizing events. And people always ask, how fast do your rides go? And they go exactly as fast as the slowest person on them. So we want people just to get out and ride. We work on enforcement to make sure traffic regulations are being enforced, working in engineering to get more bike lanes, paths, sidewalks, multi-use paths. Also, we do a lot of work with education to teach children and adults how to operate their vehicles, whether their bikes or, in the case of adults, drivers, to operate them safely. And we do evaluation. We actually do bike census counts. So I stand on a corner in Savannah with volunteers every fall, and we count people on bikes going by. And then finally, there's an equity component. We have a campaign or a program where we take donated bikes and volunteers recondition them, and then we give them away to people who need bikes to get to work or to school or to other destinations.
So this is not a bike share. How are you funded?
We are a membership organization. We receive some grants, and we are scrounging for pennies everywhere we can get them, to be honest.
Well, Savannah's a pretty good city for biking. It's pretty flat, right?
We've done an excellent job of keeping the ground flat, so that's something I'm proud of. And it makes it so that in Savannah, people of all ages and abilities can ride bikes, and that's not true in other parts of the state. So naturally, we have an area where people can make bicycling a healthy part of their daily lives if we provide infrastructure that makes them feel safe and comfortable while doing so.
Well, this is a big problem for cycling everywhere, but I've heard it particularly in some areas of the South. Safety, drivers not necessarily used to sharing the road with cyclists. Are there any kind of laws or provisions on the books about how that should be done?
Well, Georgia does have a 3-foot passing law that requires you, if you're operating a car, to leave at least 3 feet when you're overtaking or following a cyclist. So people, I do lots of presentations and I ask who's aware of that. And I can say that with every passing year, more hands go up. But people need to recognize that when you see someone on a bicycle on a street, they are legally entitled to be there. And they may not just be out there having fun. They may be trying to get to work just like you. So we encourage everybody to realize that bicycles belong on the streets and they're used not just for recreation, but transportation too.
So you have to, if you're getting dedicated bike lanes, for example, you have to work with the cities and towns. How difficult or easy is it to get the city on board with these kind of initiatives?
We've had some great partnerships, and one of the things we realize is this is going to sound strange, but try to take the bicycle out of the equation a little bit. So we've been had great luck with organizations like the Coastal Georgia Indicators Coalition, which tracks the amount of green space, the amount of active transportation infrastructure, such as bike lanes and sidewalks, and let people recognize that all of these types of infrastructure are good for you whether you ride a bike or not. So a lot of people don't imagine themselves as bicyclists, and I'm on a mission to change that, but even if you're not, better sidewalks, trails have public health benefits, as we heard early in the show, but economic, social as well. So even people who don't ride bikes benefit from all these types of things.
Well, Vernice, this is part of your area of expertise, the social interactions, the big whole picture. Getting people to share the road is a pretty difficult thing, especially because there's so much pressure on the roads and so many drivers. Talk about the whole, pulling back that picture, the whole social interaction of how people get around, how they use the land in the cities they live in.
Well, again, that isn't my particular area of expertise, but when it comes to spaces and sharing these spaces and mobility, I think that's an important piece to consider. And there has been research talking about some of those very points in the sense of these spaces help others feel welcome and being able to move from place to place and have a say in their experience, residential experience.
Well, and access is another thing that you have certainly looked at. But the idea of what John is doing, he's refurbishing bicycles and giving them to people in Savannah who don't have another mode of transportation. How does that affect, you know, just being able to access, get out there? How does that affect people's well-being and how they interact with the world?
Well, again, that I haven't done a particular study on that, but I think when it comes to the opportunity of equity in the sense of having access to a bike or other resources to promote health beneficial activity, that's something to consider.
Well, John, what's your vision for the future of Savannah Bicycle Campaign? Does this campaign have a finish line or, an election?
No, and the Russians will not be involved. I'm determined to make that happen. But we are working not just for bikes, but for people who walk, too. And in Savannah, bike lanes are used by people who use wheelchairs, people who are pushing strollers. So it's not so much about the bike as it is transportation options. And in a lot of communities, the Beltline, for example, was an abandoned rail corridor. We don't have very many of those here, but we do have canal banks. So we've been working with organizations such as the East Coast Greenway Alliance and the Savannah Development and Renewal Authority to identify potential to activate some of these existing facilities for use for neighborhood connectivity, helping people reach recreational destinations or that they serve as recreational destinations on their own.
Well, John, thanks so much. Now we're going to move on to Macon, where Danny Glover, not that Danny Glover, is founder of One South Community Development Corporation, Macon's first urban agrihood. Good morning, Danny.
Good morning. How are you?
Very well. So tell me what an agrihood is.
All right. So one correction, we'll be Georgia's first urban agrihood that's located in Macon, Georgia. But basically, agrihood is a concept that was developed in Detroit, Michigan by a guy named Tyson Gersh. He's a part of the Michigan Urban Farming program. So I had a chance to meet and have a couple tours with Tyson a few years ago and moved back home after working on the campaign trail and launched this project. So basically what we're doing, we're taking blighted properties within my home neighborhood, properties that have abandoned houses, overgrown lots and stuff of that nature. And we're converting that to active farm space, about an acre and a half right now. And on that farmland, we're going to have farm space for growing, but we're also building an urban agrihood concept, whereas we'll have a food farm-to-table restaurant, we'll have commercial kitchen space for cooking demonstrations, and just creating a place within our neighborhood, but also solving a long-term neighborhood issue, which is access to healthy and fresh produce, which is constantly being...
But this is something that Mario mentioned to us as well for building resilience. But gardening, long tradition in Macon and Middle Georgia forever. And you grew up near Bowdoin Street, which is where one of your developments are. How has Macon changed during your life in terms of access to things like fresh produce and green space for activities?
Yeah, Macon has changed a lot. Like the neighborhood I'm from, Knott Street and Bowden Street, you know, it's a neighborhood of residents who migrated from rural Georgia, you know, in the 40s and 50s. And when through that migration, they brought the recipes, they brought the histories, they brought the skill sets of how to garden and tend to the land. So what you find in that neighborhood is, you know, the past remnants of, like, you know, small, you know, household gardens. Like my grandmother had a garden, and that's how I was introduced to the whole process. Now, granted, at 5 and 6 and 8 and 9, I may not have been so enthused to get out there and weed it and put in that sweat equity. But later in life, you know, I learned that, you know, those skills has are really been used to rebuild a neighborhood and also, you know, improve our quality of life. So the history is already there and we're just re-tapping into it.
There are a number of food deserts reportedly in Macon. So what is that like? What are the consequences for residents?
So the consequences are dire. I mean, in my particular zip code, 31201, is one of Georgia's most distressed food insecure areas in the state. You know, in that one zip code, you have most of all of the county's public housing projects. You know, there are extreme cases of high poverty. There are extreme cases of violence. You know, so all of the elements in which, you know, lead to, you know, unhealthy life outcomes exist within that zip code. So, you know, you have parents, you know, who stay in Bowden homes, you know, don't have access to a car. Kroger just closed recently. So the closest one, which was about 5 to 6 miles away, just closed, and it wasn't as accessible on the bus. So now, you know, they just have to figure it out. Now they have to make a choice between going to a local neighborhood store with, you know, with produce and meat that's not as fresh as the Kroger would offer, you know, with no other options. So, you know, we're hoping to fill that gap. You know, we're hoping to decimate that zip code's food desert. And we're excited about the project.
So, Venice, Danny's talking about Macon changing, the city changing access. How about access to, you know, forests or lack of forests contribute to a whole revitalization project in cities?
I think there have been an ingredient in that process, but I think he also brought up a number of other issues that we have to keep in mind, that parks and green spaces are only one variable of a much larger health equation that can include issues such as crime and housing and social economic status. So it's a part of the process, but we also have to be mindful to not make it the entire solution.
Right. Okay. So we want to thank you so much, Danny, for speaking with us from Macon. Appreciate your time and keep up the great work.
Thank you.
Heather Benham is executive director of the Athens Land Trust, and she's joining us on the line from Athens. Heather, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us about the Athens Land Trust beginnings. Now, this was back in the 90s. What were its original goals?
Originally, we were founded to protect land from development and to provide affordable housing. Our founders were pretty ahead of the curve in seeing how land use impacts different segments of the community in different ways. So the more land you protect, the more expensive land is, which begins to price people out. So there's a lot of things to take into account when you're looking at land use, and we try to do that here.
Well, Athens Land Trust continues to work on conservation and affordable housing, but one of its newest and most notable missions is community agriculture, which is becoming a theme today. Mm-hmm. Community agriculture, working the land and having access to it. Tell us about the community or communities your gardens serve.
Yeah, we're in a number of communities around Athens. We have 15 community gardens and then 2 urban farms. And most of our gardens are located either in low-income neighborhoods or at places where people in need are gathering so that there's community being built around the garden.
So what kind of changes have you observed there in Athens as a result of these community gardens?
Yeah, there's several things. One thing I will say, you were talking earlier about the double food stamp program, the double SNAP dollars,
right.
and how many people are utilizing the program. And I would say from the first year we started our farmers market, I thought this is going to take a generation to change. It's going to take so long for people to understand how to cook, how to prepare healthy and fresh food. And I'm glad to say I'm wrong. We're 5 years in, and it has been a massive sea change, I think, in the whole community, recognizing how their health is impacted by what we're eating. So that's one big change.
Well, green space can mean any number of things. We're talking about urban agriculture in this case, farmers markets. Mm-hmm. Why? What does it do for the people there in Athens to have access to this way of connecting with nature and connecting with the land? What do you see there in a place that in many ways was a traditional farming country?
Right. Well, I think one thing, like you've talked about earlier, it's not just about the green space. It's how you're using the land to benefit communities. And so when you're establishing farms or farmers markets or ways for people to increase their income, either by growing food so they're not having to spend as much on it or by creating a business so that they can sell and better support their families or themselves, I think that's where you start to get a lot of buy-in. And then the other thing that we've seen, which it's been pretty magical, is kids. That's the big shift. You know, getting kids outside, we provide first-time job opportunities for a lot of at-risk high school students through our farming programs. And to see kids thrive by being outside and creating a new generation of kids that are connected to the land and want to see it protected and supported, I think that's what's going to change things in the long term. As more communities become urbanized and more people are living in urban areas, if we want to create a new generation of stewards for our land, we got to find ways to benefit everyone with it.
Venice, your thoughts on that gentrification? Let's say farmers markets often associated with gentrifying areas. Do you think that's a safe? It may be a stereotype, but maybe is that a bad assumption?
I'm not sure about that one.
So, do you think in gentrifying areas, however, this access to food is going to become a part of the way that people think about where they want to live, where they want to be in the development of these spaces?
Well, there has been an area of research that has linked access to these spaces with residential satisfaction in terms of how you have an attachment to where you live, or as they call in the social sciences, a sense of place. That is important for one's development and overall perception.
And do you think as we're moving forward in, you know, more and more urban spaces being developed in Georgia and the emptying out in many places of, in many parts of the state, of people and population, that this call for more green spaces is going to connect to the sense of need and sense of place for Georgians?
I think there's great potential there. And the panelists this morning have brought up ways in which that connects people to their locations, whether that's in the sense of youth development, which is something that we've also discussed in previous research. Again, how young people connect to these spaces or see themselves as a part of the solution, not only when it comes to land conservation, but how these spaces help their development.
So you think Heather's hitting it out of the park with the kids there?
Hey, she's getting some great traction.
Heather, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And Venice Jennings, thank you for sticking with us through thick and thin,
putting you
on the hot seat there.
Thank you.
Biological scientists at the U.S. Forest Service in Athens. We also heard from Danny Glover of the nonprofit One South Community Development Corporation and John Bennett, executive director of the Savannah Bicycle Campaign. Thanks to everybody who gave us a little sense of green space on the radio today. I'm Virginia Prescott. Meet you here again tomorrow. On Second Thought is a production of GPB News.